Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the UC Irvine campus. We're streaming live on KUCI.org. And this show, along with all the others, will be podcast on iTunes. Look for Writers on Writing. Today is Wednesday, October, what is it? Are we on the 23rd, 24th? You know, I'm sort of losing track of time. I think it's the 24th, Wednesday, October 24th, 2018. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guests today are novelists Martin Zusak and Lisa Unger. First up is Martin Zusak. He's the author of the international bestseller, The Book Thief, and I Am the Messenger, an LA Times Book Award finalist. The Book Thief was named one of the best books of 2006 by many publications, with glowing reviews everywhere, of course, the New York Times Book Review, et cetera, et cetera. He's here to talk about his new novel, Bridge of Clay. I'm so happy to have him. Hey, Marcus.
Hey, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
Oh, of course. Let's begin by talking about Bridge of Clay. It was something like, I don't know, 20 years in the making, 13 years in the making. Talk about the process of from idea to this copy I have here before me.
Yeah, well, I probably had the idea when I was about 20, and I'm 43 now, so it's really been 23 years from the very first idea till it's finally been finished. And but I've been working on it really fully for the last 10 years, And it was just one of those books. Some books you can write in a year or 3 months, and some books take a decade. And this has just been, I guess, one of those books that I'm kind of glad it took me that long, because some of my favourite little moments in it are things I only thought of, you know, even at the very start of this year when I was doing the last edit. So I guess a book is as long as its ideas and takes as long as its ideas to write.
So, and you worked on other things in between?
Not really.
No? Really?
It's funny because between the first idea and this, yes, I mean, so I think I always thought of Bridge of Clay, about this boy wanting to make one beautiful thing and molding his whole life into this bridge. I always felt like that was my best idea and the one that I loved the most. And so I kept pushing it back and pushing it back, and so I went other books in between in that time, but in the last decade, I didn't want to see anything else. And people would often say to me, it was one of my favourite things, people would say, you're having so much trouble with this book, why don't you just write one of your other ideas? And I'd say, well, that's the problem. You know, I haven't got any other ideas. But now I realise every idea I was having was going into this book, and I was kind of really wanting to bet everything I had. And I think sometimes, a lot of the time, that's what you got to do when you write a book, is you just got to back yourself and bet everything, or else, you know, kind of in some ways, what's the point?
Yeah, exactly. What's the point? Well, you know, I think on the first, is it in the prologue? Pretty soon, it must be. It must be in the very first section that there's a typewriter that is kind of found in dirt, and I wondered how that came to be.
Well, that was one of the very last. That was one of the very last things that happened when I was struggling with the book, and I actually quit the book at just for less than 24 hours, because then I had this idea. And in the backstory, so Matthew Dunbar, who's telling the story about his brother Clay, he knows the story of his dad or their father who buries his pet dog and a snake who battled each other back in a country town or an old backyard of a town all these decades earlier. And I thought, oh, what if he buried his mum's typewriter out there as well and protected it lovingly in a really heavy plastic sheet? And so just all of a sudden I felt play in the book again. I felt joy and just almost, and it came through in not only the idea of the plot, but just in the actual language as well. And I find that's when I'm at my happiest, is when you feel like you do all this work on a book, and sometimes it's a struggle, even if it's a joyful struggle, but then you get to a point where you just, like climbing a mountain with the promise of a sandpit at the top. And And the idea of the typewriter, that was me sitting in the sandpit telling, this is what I love about writing.
Well, you know, I'm obsessed with typewriters, as many people know, and I'm curious if you ever use them in your writing life.
Yeah, I definitely have, and I've always, you know, and I've had the problem with the ribbon and all that stuff, and I had one that could only use a red ribbon, it's all just something that I loved, and the orange typewriter that I had was this old one from the 70s or something like that. So, you know, I had a really, and I've still got it, and I love how you can stick magnets and things to it. So it's just this old, beautiful thing that I think it's part of our history, and I don't know a single writer who doesn't love typewriters.
Yeah, I was very happy to see the typewriter in your book. You know, I'm always curious with novels, especially long novels that obviously take revision and take years to write. Was the beginning always the beginning?
No, well, it's funny. This book had a different narrator for about 6 years, and it was a girl who lived across the road, but there was always a beginning where she was sitting on the house of the Dunbars, so Clay's, you know, where Clay, the main character, grew up, and she was telling the story from there. And then when I changed to Matthew, he was sitting on the roof, and one of the big breakthroughs was something really simple and not even that imaginative, but I brought Matthew inside the house, into the kitchen, where so much happens in the book, and I thought, now he's, instead of writing from the outside in, he's writing from the inside out, and he's writing in the place where so much of the novel's action happens, as I think happens in a lot of our lives, certainly in mine, that so much happens in the kitchen. And so once I had that, you know, tiny little breakthrough, it was almost like just a little hole that then I was able to reach through and just pull that world out more entirely. So no, the beginning is never really the beginning. And that's what the book is talking about a lot of the time anyway, that there are beginnings everywhere. And we never stop going backwards and forwards in our memories, even as we're living life forwards as well. And that's something that the book does all the time.
But how do you keep track? You know, there's a lot of characters, a lot happens in this book. It spans a wide period of time, and I can't imagine that you keep it all in your head. I mean, do you have, you know, cards pinned to the walls of your office? Do you have like a roll of newsprint that winds around the walls of your office with everything sketched out? How do you keep track?
No, I pretty much have it all in my head, But I basically plot a novel by just writing out chapter headings over and over and over again. And so in the 11 notebooks that I used to write Bridge of Clay, even up to early this year, I still have chapter headings written out. And so I know in part one, there are going to be these 8 chapters. This is going to happen in each of them. Part two, and I know just by looking at the chapter headings where I am, how far back in the story or how far forward or where I am geographically. And that's how I see the world of the book. I tried all sorts of other things over the years. I did have a bit of a, you know, a laundry element where I had things pegged up. But I think those were more just, you know, you try all these things that you feel like might work, but you know you're just putting off the real work. And so I just find notebook, chapter headings, and then write. And I try to keep all that, you know, the mess of that in my head as well. And mostly, I live with it every day, and I would be able to recite pages from the book in my head as I was, you know, walking around, walking my dogs or taking my kids to school. And, you know, you're just sort of not muttering away, but just always hearing it in your head. And so it's like you live both next to it and inside it all the time, and that's how I always knew where I was with it.
Do you also read aloud? Would you read aloud from whatever you're working on to get into the voice, or no?
Absolutely. I mean, that's how I edit, how I edited this book, and how I pretty much probably edited all of my books is to read them aloud. And sometimes I think that's a strength, and sometimes not. I think because it's not exactly how I read novels in general, is I don't read books aloud. But you know, it's the best way to know how it's feeling, how it's sounding, and just to get the actual rhythm of the book as well. So and it's kind of nice to do that. I'd often record myself too, just to keep myself honest.
Well, you're also the reader on the audio version. And I'm so curious what that was like and how long that took for this book. And was it like an 8-hour day, many days, or how did that go?
Yeah, it took about a week and a half, and it was the perfect way to say goodbye to the book. And actually, you know, and I loved it. I loved the collegiality of leaving my house, you know, instead of being surrounded by my own self every day. I was going out like other people to work, and I loved working with the producer. And it was in Sydney on the other side of the harbour, and you could see the harbour bridge. It was great. But it was just the perfect way to say goodbye to a book that I'd, you know, spent the last decade with. And I couldn't change anything anymore in that. So it's sort of like all bets are off there. And so the hardest thing was actually just reading slowly enough. Because when I read it to myself, I would just read it in 2 days. And I would just highlight the things I wasn't happy with and come back to them. So the hardest thing was slowing down. The mistake rate was low because I know the book so well. I know every full stop, comma, everything in it. And the biggest problem was probably my stomach rumbling. And so I'd have to go back and redo those bits because they'd say, oh, stomach rumble. And so it was, it was just a great experience. And I kind of loved every minute of it.
Yeah, getting out of the office and being with others around the work can be just, I hear you. It's sort of a joyous, extroverted experience after being alone.
Yeah, and well, I mean, we had, so, you know, it only took about a day and a half to have a whole subset of in-jokes and laughs. It was just, you know, I look back so happily on it, you know. And I mean, even, I remember the guy I did it with, a guy called Stuart, and he'd say something like, you know, I might be on drugs, but I think I heard something in the background there. And so everything after that was, you know, I might be on drugs, but was there something wrong there? And sure enough, there would be something just slightly off or whatever. So it just became, you know, a really great time.
You know, I read something recently that I didn't realize that this even happens, but working with different editors in various countries for different publishers and publications, that there are changes that happen in the book. And I had no idea I know about translation and all of that, and things can just naturally change. But in terms of making changes for different countries, for different publishers, what changes? I mean, if I read, say, the Australian version of Bridge of Clay, what would I notice as different?
This was the thing. That book is pretty much, I can tell you one tiny thing that is different between the two editions, apart from a few, like a list of kind of Americanizations of things, where we call a cooler an Esky, and even little things like, you know, the boot of the car becomes the trunk of the car. And in some ways, you know, I'm not going to lie, like sometimes that can be a bit frustrating. But on the other, it's also just one of those things that's workable. And what we did at home to make sure there was uniformity, because I would get first pages, second pages from both America and Australia. The British publisher, so all the English-speaking publishers, I got notes from everyone, but we made a conscious decision early on that we wanted one book. And so that book is the same book in every territory. Apart from those tiny little things that people, you know, just, you know, help some people along. I mean, there was one case where I had two descriptions that I had worked with, and And but I left one in the American one and one in the Australian one. That's the one thing that is different in the whole book. And it's just the way Clay carries a clothespin. Well, that's one of the things we left, was that we just call them pegs. And so he's got a peg, and in the Australian one and the American one, in one it just says it was stenciled to his thigh from lying on it through the night, and in the other one it says something like it's out, the perimeter was outlined to his thigh, or something like that. And I just I like that little idiosyncrasy, that that's the one tiny little thing that's different, but other than that, totally the same book.
Mm. Interesting. And something else that I found interesting too is that I think only in the United States is Bridge of Clay categorized as YA. And I know so many people who've read The Book Thief, adults who've read The Book Thief, and adults who are reading Bridge of Clay. And I'm so curious about that. And I wonder what you think about that.
Well, in this case, it was just because I have a real sense of loyalty and love for the people I work with here. And I kind of knew, we always knew that people who read The Book Thief, young adults read it or teenagers read it, but it has probably a greater adult readership. And so in the end, you just think a book's going to have to make its own way in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think of the idea that a loved book transcends the category it comes from anyway. And so, but yeah, you're right. I mean, it's not technically a young adult book. It's doing a few things differently, but I'm happy that it's written. and the idea is just that I like the idea that teenagers, people say, oh, can teenagers cope with this? And you say, of course they can. I mean, the one thing we can never do is underestimate teenagers as well. And I think we need books that are written for them and say, this is in your voice.
Mm-hmm.
But here we've got a 31-year-old older brother narrating a book, and you can say, well, this is for you as well if you want, but you've got to come up here to read it. And I'm more than fine with that.
Yeah, and that's true. Categorization can, I think, really drive writers crazy. But you're right. I mean, books will find the people that are meant to find them. And, word of mouth does wonders, and how many people are reading reviews to decide what they're going to read and in what category.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's... Yeah, I mean, and in the end, you look back, I sort of say, well, in 5 years, we'll judge how well this book's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And that was how I felt about The Book Thief, too. And it might come earlier, it might come later. And either way, the book is there, it's out in the world, and you hope it'll find its right audience.
You know, speaking of The Book Thief, again, you have been asked if you'd do a sequel to it. And you said, I think you said something like, no, that would cheapen it. And I'm so curious what you meant by that.
Well, I say never say never, but I was even, saying to people last night that I'll never write a sequel to that book, because The Book Thief, The Book Thief in its own small, charmed way has just had a kind of magical life. And it's a lucky book, it's the first book I'd ever written where I thought, I've always wanted to write books that really mean something to me, but that book meant everything to me. And I just feel like, I've read books in the past that I loved, and then there's a sequel, and you go, oh, I kind of wish that hadn't been written.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all. It's just it means something out to me, that book. And I just feel like just let that be as it is, and let people take the characters beyond the pages themselves, which is one of the things I love about writing and books in general.
Mm. We have just a few minutes left, but I would love to hear you read just a little bit so we can hear Bridge of Clay in your voice.
Mm-hmm. See what I can do here. I'll just see if I can pull it out of my bag. And I can read something. Is there anything in particular?
Oh, gee. I mean, I always think starting at the beginning is a good idea, but that's up to
you. Sure, I can do that, and I can see how Matthew, the narrator, sounds, and I'll just read that first little passage on the first page.
That'd
and then
be great.
We'll see how we go.
Okay.
Okay, so this is Before the Beginning, the old TW. In the beginning, there was one murderer, one mule, and one boy, but this isn't the beginning, it's before it, it's me.
and I'm Matthew, and here I am in the kitchen, in the night, the old river mouth of light, and I'm punching and punching away. The house is quiet around me. As it is, everyone else is asleep. I'm at the kitchen table. It's me and the typewriter. Me and the old TW, as our long-lost father said our long-lost grandmother used to say. Actually, she called it the old TW, but such quirks have never been me. Me? I'm known for bruises and level-headedness, for height and muscle and blasphemy, and the occasional sentimentality. If you're like most people, you wonder if I'd bother stringing a sentence together, let alone know anything about the epics or the Greeks. Sometimes it's good to be underestimated that way, but even better when someone sees it. In my case, I was lucky. For me, there was Claudia Kirkby. There was a boy and a son and a brother. Yes, always for us, there was a brother, and he was the one of us amongst the five of us, who took all of it on his shoulder. As ever, he told me quietly and deliberately, and of course, he was on the money. There was an old typewriter buried in the old backyard of an old backyard of a town, but I'd had to get my measurements right, or I might dig up a dead dog or snake instead, which I did on both counts. I figured if the dog was there and the snake was there, the typewriter couldn't be far. It was perfect, pirateless treasure.
Thank you so much. That was Marcus Zusak reading from Bridge of Clay, published by Knopf. You know, I love the rhythm of your writing, and it's quite musical. And I wonder, you know, we talked about reading aloud a little while ago, but are you looking for that when you're reading? Are you looking for that music? Are you making sure that, you know, that you got the beat, or that maybe a syllable needs to go or a syllable needs to come in? I mean, how are you working with that sound and that rhythm?
Yeah, it was something that was really fundamental to this book in particular. What I realized is that I wasn't good at writing poetry, but I wanted there to be something poetic about the way I wrote prose. And that was when suddenly my writing came to life. I mean, and this is, you know, a decade and a half ago. And so that was how I always wanted to write. And so every comma is considered, every word choice is considered, because not even all same syllable words do the same thing to a sentence. So you can have a one syllable word in a sentence that completely changes the rhythm when you put it in. And then if you put another word in its place that just has a longer single syllable, it makes all the difference to the sentence. So this was something that I was really interested in this book in particular as well, because, you know, there is an influence of the Iliad and the Odyssey, and so just these long poems, and that's kind of what Matthew is doing without writing, a novel that is written in poetry form. But I like the idea that there is actual poetry in the prose itself, and that's just how I've always loved to write. So I'm always interested in the rhythm. Every part of the rhythm in this book is considered and work to exactly how I wanted it to be.
Yeah, it's quite lovely. And and we're out of time, and I so appreciate you being here. You're going to actually be in the neighborhood Friday night. Marcus will be at the Norman Murray Center in Mission Viejo, and if you want to see him and get a book and hear him talk and read more, look at the Mission Viejo Library website, and that will lead you to buy tickets. I think a book is included in the price of a ticket. And anyway, it's just been quite a pleasure. Thank you so much, Marcus.
No worries, Barbara. Thanks for having me, and that'll be a fun night, I hope. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't just a thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Oh, honey, just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just a thought of you,
just a thought,
my love, my whole world turns misty blue.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We continue to broadcast at UC Irvine on the campus, and we're streaming live at KUCI.org. And this podcast, along with hundreds, maybe thousands of others, will be on the website. You could go to penonfire.com or go to iTunes, subscribe to Writers on Writing. And when we upload a new show, which is usually within a couple of days of the show, you'll find it in your file on your phone or computer, wherever your podcasts are located. In any case, we spent the first half with Martin Suzak, author of Bridge of Clay. We're back with Lisa Unger. Her novel is Under My Skin. And Lisa is a New York Times, an international best-selling and award-winning author. Her books are published in 26 languages worldwide, have sold millions of copies, and have been named Best of the Year or Top Picks by the Today Show, Good Morning America, Entertainment Weekly, on and on. I want to talk about Under My Skin, published just recently, and let's bring her right on. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Oh, great to have you. And I want to say I'm new to your work, happily so. I think one of the wonderful things about books is how when a writer or when a reader finds a book or an author she's never read, a whole new world opens up. And there's so many more books to read usually when you discover a writer who's on her way in her career. And I'm curious how you found your way to the thriller genre.
You know, it's funny. I get that question a lot. Usually, after people meet me, because I'm sort of an upbeat personality, and I think people kind of tend to expect me to be a little bit darker than I am. And but I don't feel like I chose psychological suspense or thriller or mystery, whatever we're calling it these days, any more than I chose to be a writer in the first place. You know, I've always sort of defined myself that way. I don't remember a time before I thought of myself as a writer, and I've also always had this kind of dark imagination. Like, I always sort of liken it to, you know, when you're at the movies and you're, watching, a horror flick, and, you know, there's a sound in the basement, and there's, a girl headed into the, headed down there to check out what the noise is, and everyone in the theater is like, no, you know, don't go down those stairs. I'm the girl going down the stairs because I want to know what's hiding in the dark.
So, you know, in terms of what you just said, in terms of categories, I mean, how would you categorize your book?
I mean, I guess I always think of them as sort of character-driven psychological suspense. You know, for me, all plot flows from character. Mm-hmm. You know, I usually have sort of a seed or germ of an idea, and it usually leads me to a lot of research on a topic that fascinates me. And then I start to hear a voice or voices, and it's those voices that I follow through my narrative. So for me, it kind of begins and ends with character. And, you know, I don't know how many of us are actually, I mean, certainly some of us are, but most people who have been writing all their lives the way I have been, you know, you're really just sort of exploring ideas and characters, and, you know, the idea of what it's going to be when it's done doesn't actually occur, you know, because you're writing so far along before you ever imagine yourself to be published, you know. And those categories are the work of publishers and booksellers. You know, they have to know where to put your book, how to sell your book. So, you know, for me and for most of the people I know who write, you know, we're just exploring these worlds and these characters and these, you know, we're doing this sort of dream weaving thing, and the idea of genre is the secondary or, you know, tertiary or not at all.
Right, and I suppose it comes up, I mean, it has to come up when you write your query letter, unless you just happen to know an agent or you run into somebody and they want to read your stuff. But, you know, there in the first paragraph, you have to say what it is, and then trying to kind of define what it is sometimes can be pretty trying.
Yeah, and yeah. I think that it's kind of an unfair thing to ask writers, but it's something that, you know, especially these days, you know, in the query process, I mean, obviously for me that was a super long time ago, but, you know, you very much so have to, you know, say, hey, I'm writing this type of book in the vein of this type of book, you may even be called upon to say, like, I have this social media platform, or I have this speaking schedule, or, like, whatever it is that, you know, where you can be a partner to your publisher mm-hmm. in selling the work. So that's a very other, but that's a very other part of the brain from the creative brain.
Yeah, sure is. Well, yeah. Well, in terms of Under My Skin, so, okay, you started with protagonist Poppy, but then what? I mean, did you spend time trying to figure out what she needed, what needed to kind of come up in terms of obstacles? Or did, you know, I mean, how did that go with starting with character, with the character of Poppy?
Yeah, so basically the germ for Under My Skin was a Carl Jung thought or an idea. I have like sort of an ongoing obsession with Carl Jung. It's like, you know, those themes kind of run through mm-hmm. all 16 of my novels. And in this case, it was a thought which was, between the dreams of day and night, there is not so great a difference. And it's a very simple mm-hmm. sort of turn of phrase, but, you know, with all Jungian thought, it has a lot of layers, and it got me to thinking, between the dreams of day and night, what does he mean by that? So it got me, you know, sort of interested in the idea of sleeping and dreaming. So that's where, that was the next step. After the germ, there's the research. So I started researching sleep and discovered that we spend about 229,000 hours of our lives sleeping. Mm. That's more time than we spend doing anything else, working or driving or eating. And yet, you know, we're totally convinced that whatever's happening in our waking life is more real than what's happening in our dream life. And Carl Jung was very invested in dreams, and he used them in his therapy for patients, and he thought it was the doorway to the unconscious and to the collective unconscious. So these are like the kind of ideas that were kicking around in my brain. Also other thoughts about trauma and addiction. So these are like the kind of things that obsess me, right? And so then I started hearing the voice of Poppy Lang, and she's a young widow. This is all I really knew about her at the time, and she's a photographer, so she has that kind of interesting eye and perspective on the world. And I know that she's, you know, suffered a terrible loss, a terrible trauma, and that when we first find her, she's in a very sort of dark place. And that's all I know about her, or really most any of my characters. That's all I know when I sort of sit down to write. But I'm hearing this voice, so I literally just start writing. And in a lot of ways, I feel like the story's already there, and I'm just looking for it. You know, so I write without an outline. I don't know who's going to show up day to day. I don't know what they're going to do. I definitely don't know how the book is going to end. So in a lot of ways, I'm writing for the same reason that I read, because I want to know what's going to happen to the people living in my head.
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, okay, so you said you heard her voice, and then, you know, she started taking form as a character. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I mean, how did you hear her voice, or how did she appear to you? I mean, had you been thinking, I want to do a protagonist, a female, a photographer, or this or that? Or,
nothing
or...
like that. There's no, like, conscious decision about, like, who she is. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, and I know that this is not the truth of it, but this is, like, sort of how I experience it. Like, I honestly have a long time ago stopped thinking about character as somebody I create. Like, I'm never going to sit down and say, I want to create this protagonist who does this thing and it leads to this thing. Like, that's not how it works for me. So if every character is like sort of, you know, some kind of alchemy of my imagination, my observations, my experiences, my prejudice, like whatever it is that I'm bringing to the page, like I really do experience it as somebody that I meet and who literally just evolves on the page for me in the same way that somebody that I met evolves. Like we reveal ourselves to each other in layers as people. And for a character, it's kind of the same thing for me.
Mm. Do you worry about your characters or Poppy, do you worry about them being likable or empathetic, or, you know, are you thinking about character from that point of view? Like, I want the readers to like this one.
Yeah, I hope they're likable. I mean, some of them are and some of them kind of aren't, you know, but for me, I mean, empathy is key, right? I mean, it's key to life and it's key to writing. You know, if you don't have, you know, if you as the writer don't have tremendous emotional investment in your character and tremendous empathy for what the character is going through, then I think probably your readers are not going to be able to have that empathy either. So I tend to feel like if I can feel love and empathy and compassion for my characters and feel connected, you know, to them and to their journey and fully invested in what happens to them, then I'm hoping that relationship becomes the relationship that the reader has with those characters as well. I mean, I think it's all about what you hope that what you're experiencing in the writing of a book is what your characters are experiencing.
What about the villain or the antagonist or whatever we want to call that dark force that comes throughout? How do you want to feel about that person?
Well, I want to feel empathy for that person too, because, you know, I don't really know if I believe in the idea of heroes and villains.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if I necessarily believe that anyone is all bad and that, that anyone is all good. I mean, I think that in life, you know, you see people who make good choices a lot of the time, and then you find people who make really bad choices a lot of the time. And then there are many people who make some good choices and some bad choices most of the time. And, you know, like, I feel like being in those layers of your character and allowing your character on the page to show all sides of him or herself, like, that is the essence of sort of authentic character. I mean, I think if you've come to the work saying, okay, this is my plot and this is what I want to happen, this is the good guy and this is the bad guy and this is how I'm going to show it, then I feel like you're working from the outside in, mm-hmm. rather than working from the inside out.
Yeah, that makes sense. Someone, I think it was Todd Goldberg, said the way you make a villain or bad guy or the antagonist sympathetic is you have someone love him or her.
Right.
I thought that was kind of interesting. It's like,
yeah, okay. I mean, that makes sense,
yeah.
Because, you know, we only are slivers of ourselves in our various situations. I mean, we reveal different sides of ourselves to different people. We can be totally different,
mm-hmm.
somebody totally different for our child than we are for, you know, the person, you know, who we're in a confrontation with. You know, like, they're all different layers of us as people, and that shouldn't be any less true of the people on the page.
Yeah, exactly. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Lisa Unger. Her new book is Under My Skin. You know, something I've been noticing a lot is that mystery writers tend to not have MFAs, yet the community and the support system is so vast and probably bigger and more supportive than that for literary writers. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I've heard that a lot, and there's always a lot of, you know, very, very, like, I don't know, there's always, like, a lot of lines drawn from the literary community about what's literary and what isn't. And I think that there's a little bit of bias that's, you know, brought to the craft from people who have advanced degrees in writing. So I've experienced that many, many times. But, you know, I think within our community, you know, I mean, I know personally for myself, I have experienced just a tremendous amount of support from my fellow writers, and I know that in turn I try to support the people who are working in the craft as well, because I don't really feel like there's competition. You know, people are not just reading one book, people don't just love one writer, and, you know, I feel like I have a relationship with my readers, and, you know, I want them to experience books that I love as well, because I'm a reader first. So I'm always going to support the books that, you know, have moved me and inspire me and, you know, make me excited about the work. And I feel like a lot of my fellow writers feel that way.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I just, you know, I'll pick up a suspense novel or a thriller or something. And, you know, there's rarely anything mentioned in the bio about MFA, but you pick up a literary novel and on most literary novels, the writers have MFAs, so it's just, it's really kind of interesting. Yeah, I don't know. It's still all about the writing, you know? It's still all about the writing.
It is. It's all about the writing.
Your prologue was such a grabber, and I will ask you what I ask just about every author that comes on the show whose novel has a prologue. Was it always there from the beginning?
It was, and it almost always is. Like, and I know there's a lot of, like, there's a lot of conversation about prologues. Like, some people say, oh, I can never, you know, I never want to read it, or, you know, I skip it, you know, or, you know, you shouldn't have it. You know, there's always these, like, kind of imaginary rules that pop up, you know, for, you know, pretty much everything, right? And, but for me, you know, it is, you know, it's often where the book starts. It's always a window into the essence mm-hmm. of the story. And maybe it varies from book to book, like where in the book it's actually going to fall, but it's often my doorway into the story. So, you know, I often have prologues, and, you know, I say, ignore them at your peril.
I am so glad
if you don't read my prologue, whether you like them or not, you should at least just try. They're not very long.
Well, and your prologue, the prologue of Under My Skin, I don't see how you could ignore it. I mean, it's so important to the story.
It is. It's important. I mean, it's, in this case, it's, you know, it's definitely critical. But I mean, I feel like everything has to be critical. You know, like every piece of it, you know, you do your first draft, and then, you know, you do a second and a third and a fourth draft, and then, you know, you have your content editing, and then there's, you know, a million drafts after that. And then, you know, for me, the final, you know, sort of read through of the book where, you know, I kind of read everything aloud, you know, I ask myself, you know, is this advancing plot or character, preferably both? You know, does it mean something? Is it absolutely critical to what's going on? And, you know, there's nothing sort of escapes that lens. So if it's in the book, then it really wanted to be there. So don't skip anything.
So that's interesting, because I was going to ask you how you make sure each chapter propels the novel. I mean, suspense is important in every type of fiction, but especially in suspense or thrillers. And so, yeah, I mean, that's really interesting, because each chapter has to move it on. And
yeah, I mean, it has to, you know, it has to, you know, it has to, I mean, I think that there are a number of ways that you can, that you are propelled through your novel as a writer. So it is, like I say, wanting to know what's going to happen to the character. So it could purely just be curiosity of character, investment in the character and what's going to happen. You know, progression of the story, you know, all of the different pieces. So, I mean, I think it's really just a matter of how invested you are as a writer and how much you want it to go on. Like, if you're feeling that feeling of, like, I can't wait to get to the next thing that's going to happen, then you're, hopefully that's going to come through your reader as well.
Mm. So somewhere I read you also do series. You have a few series novels?
I have a series of books that are, it's not actually a true series. I have a fictional town called The Hollows.
Okay.
And a lot of the stories of that, a lot of my stories chain link through that place and to each other throughout a series of books. So it's not like really a true series, but it's, you know, all, it's a sort of a big story that's connected in little links to the other stories.
Mm-hmm. So do you find there to be advantages to even having this town that provides the connection as opposed to writing a standalone?
Well, what I love about the Hollows books is that, you know, the town, when it first kind of presented itself to me, I mean, I didn't really think very much of it. And in a way, it kind of felt like any town, or like the place where nothing bad ever happens, which, of course, is nowhere, because bad things happen everywhere.
Yeah.
And so it was like, that's what it felt like to me at the time. And then, you know, it became sort of a character and started to evolve and have its own, like, kind of agenda and needs and desires. And so I really loved, you know, I still do love exploring that place and seeing how it changes and how it's different for every character. But it also allows me to explore, you know, stay with some characters for a long time and really explore their evolution in interesting ways. Mm-hmm. And then it allows me to sort of honor some of the other voices in my head, so the other people that wind up populating those books as well. So it kind of gives me that, it gives me like a very broad canvas for character and story. As the standalones too, I mean, you know, it for me there's not really like sort of a preference. Like I'm either in the Hollows or I'm not. And sometimes when I'm not in the Hollows is like still trying to get into whatever whatever it is I'm writing. So it's kind of, you know, for me it's just basically honoring whoever is loudest and who needs the most bandwidth, you know, on the page.
Sure. Yeah, that's interesting. And unfortunately, we are just about at the end of our time together on the radio. And I wonder if in closing, if you have any advice or tips or last words for the novelists listening.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, one of the seminal books on creativity is The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron. Mm-hmm. And she wrote another book as well called The Right to Write. And in it, she said that, you know, we treat our aspiring novelists as if they have an embarrassing case of unrequited love. Mm. And I think that it's important to, as a writer, to give yourself permission. If you have that impulse, then it is valuable, whether you're making your career out of it or not. So you have to schedule the time for your writing and honor that schedule and remember that the only thing you need to do to be a real writer is to write.
Yeah, it's so true, huh? And yeah. Sometimes the hardest thing for people
sometimes,
to do is
sometimes
sit down.
The hardest thing to give yourself permission to do the thing that you're right. Not 100% sure that you can do.
It's kind of like what they say about saving money, right? That you, or after right. You work, that you should pay yourself first.
Right, you exactly.
So maybe sit down and do your writing first before you do anything else, just to make sure it's done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you just have to make that time and honor it that the way you would honor any other commitment that you made to yourself, even if it's just a half an hour right after you wake up. If that's all you have, if you're working and you have kids and you're going to school and, you know, we all have a million demands on our time. But if you can just find a half an hour, you know, right after you wake up to just write, you'd be amazed at how much progress you can make and how fast.
You can get a lot done in a half hour. Actually.
You can, especially in the early morning when nobody else is around.
Right, right. Lisa Unger, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
It's been so great. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. That was Lisa Unger. Her new novel is Under My Skin. It is published by Park Row Books. And that is a division of, because everything's a division of something anymore. I don't know. It's Park Row Books. And it's a good, healthy size. And the prologue, as I said, is pretty startling and very much a grabber. Anyway, that's all the time we have today. I will be with you in a couple of weeks. I think next week it's Marie. If you want to listen to this show or many others, please visit penonfire.com. You can go to iTunes, subscribe to Writers on Writing. Leave us a review if you're so inclined. We'll appreciate it because that'll kind of raise Writers on Writing in the standings on iTunes so others can find the show. Anyway, have a great week. And you writers out there, stay in the chair.